I just kind of disappeared and became part of the whole universe, and knew that that's what I'd always been. And it was a kind of infinite healing. It was indescribably beautiful. And clearly, you know, without doubt, I knew like the most important thing that had ever happened to me, to the point where I could have died that night and known that my life was fulfilled.
Hello and welcome to Waking Up with Brooke Sproul. My guest today is the wonderful Henry Schuckman. Henry, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, so lovely to connect with you. We have quite a bit in common, from spirituality and meditation to poetry and psychology. So I have a feeling we'll have a very rich conversation today. So talk about your background with meditation and spirituality. I know you had kind of a spontaneous awakening experience. Would you like to share about that?
When I was 19, I had, this thing happened out of nowhere where my ordinary sense of things just fell away. I was looking at the light of the sun in late afternoon on the water, and I was stone cold sober, and really never, barely hadn't been in my life, you know, and had basically, you know, occasionally drank some beer as a teenager and stuff, smoked some hash, but nothing beyond that, and no interest in anything esoteric or mystical or spiritual. And suddenly I just kind of disappeared and became part of the whole universe, and knew that that's what I'd always been. And it was a kind of infinite healing. It was indescribably beautiful. And clearly, you know, without doubt, I knew like the most important thing that had ever happened to me, to the point where I could have died that night and known that my life was fulfilled.
Wow.
And I actually, you know, what in the way of things, I didn't die, and life went on, and I had a blissful few weeks, and then I went home. I'd been away far from home on a gap year when this thing happened, and when I got home, almost immediately, I was really kind of hammered by all the unexamined childhood trauma that I'd lived with, which was, you know, mostly about two things: a very difficult domestic situation, you know, with parental and stuff. And secondly, I had a chronic, rather severe skin condition throughout my childhood, and which I'd become free of while I was away. And so I came home, and suddenly, you know, all the unfelt feelings of my childhood that I'd sort of managed to compartmentalize so I could kind of function when I was a kid, I was so open that all of it just sort of swamped me, and I had no significant resources for dealing with it, and I was completely overwhelmed and went into a kind of deep despair, which I kind of lived. I sort of kind of lived with for a few years, and then actually that's when I started to meditate. In my early 20s, I think I was actually 24, I started meditating, and that was the way that my sort of healing journey really began. Because fairly soon after I started meditating regularly, I realized that something was off. I wasn't happy, and I hadn't been for a long time, and that I could do something about it. And I started getting into therapy.
So how do you see the difference between spirituality and psychology?
That's such a great question. The difference between psychology and spirituality. I mean, of course, you know, they can mean a lot of different things, and undoubtedly there's a whole lot of overlap, and in a certain way, I mean, I feel my journey has been and continues to be absolutely about both of them. And I would say, maybe it's just sort of almost for the sake of convenience, that sort of in my understanding, you know, spirituality can encompass, for one thing, non-dual experience. It can encompass what we call awakening, which is where, you know, our sense of self isn't sort of improved, tended, cultivated, developed. It simply is seen through. It's seen that it's always been an illusion. Mm-hmm. And we discover that when that illusion is no longer kind of hooking us or capturing us, we're actually part of a great whole that is everything. And it's, you know, it's an incredible discovery to make. And I do think it's a discovery, meaning that it's kind of real, because I believe, and there's a lot of neuroscience these days and other kinds of investigation supporting, you know, the sort of contention that the sense of self as we normally experience it as stable and fixed and separate from all else is actually a kind of illusion. But leaving that aside, I also think it's kind of terrible not to tend our self. I think we must, I mean, I've had to bring, you know, learn to bring a loving, welcoming attention and awareness to what I feel I am, so that the sense of self that I can still plug into, can still experience, is cared for. So you see, I don't really, I mean, some people, you know, hardcore non-dual folks would say, I'm wrong, there isn't a self, just ignore it, you know, kind of thing. But to whatever extent you're getting caught by things and having intense negative emotion, that's just the extent to which you're still hooked by this thing that you've got to get unhooked from. But I actually, I mean, I think they may be right, I don't know. But and I must say, I've had periods of time when I might have even said that myself, but I really don't see it that way now. I feel we've got to a well-rounded kind of, almost I'd say wholesome and sort of integrated spirituality actually must include psychological tending as well. And I sort of feel I don't really want to lean on one side and exclude the other. If you
are familiar with Ken Wilber's work at all?
Yes, some of it. I've read. Oh man, he's great. I've loved. I haven't read a whole lot, but I've read bits and pieces. I mean, man, that whole pre-trans fallacy thing is brilliant.
Just talking to John Verbeke about that last week. Really, really interesting stuff that I think we could dive into a little bit. But there's a few different things I wanted to touch on from what you shared. You know, Ken Wilber talks about transcending and including. So it feels, you know, at the higher levels of development, we don't simply go to the next level and then disown the previous level. That's not an authentic developmental process. And that's not a sustainable developmental process. To the extent that I've done that, you know, kind of working with my own, say, narcissism, it's like there was a time when I was like, oh, I'm not a narcissist, but all those people are narcissists. And now this is dangerous. And now this part of me is bad. Now I've disowned it. Now it's, you know, kind of cut off in some way. And of course, then I found that everywhere around me and it didn't feel safe. And then when I was able to go back and kind of get to know that part and find empathy for that part as just the little girl who was just struggling and didn't get enough, you know, didn't feel self-worth and needed to get a sense of self from the outside world, as I was able to find just compassion for that, all of a sudden other people with those traits didn't feel threatening. And I was able to transcend it in a more authentic and grounded way where it's still a part of me. I'm not trying to get rid of it. It's no longer dangerous or a threat. And so it does feel like there's a necessity to, you know, not simply transcend, but also to include the lower levels of development. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there are people in the spiritual community who have reached a kind of awakened state of consciousness without doing the accordant spiritual work. And that's where we see all of these kind of cult leaders who are very corrupt, is they have these very mystical, I've never encountered, you know, firsthand these kind of leaders who have actual powers. I don't know if you have, I'd be very curious, but I've heard stories like Michael Singer talks about, you know, certain experiences he's had with gurus who have, you know, the ability to kind of, I don't even know that I could describe it, but in some way move energy or heal or, you know, kind of cultivate these certain states. And I don't know if I fully believe in that, but I hear that there are people like that who have these at least magnetic presences. You know, they're just captivating, they're embodied, they exude unconditional love. But then there's like the Oshas of the world where they have those traits, and then there's all of this corruption and all of this exploitation. And so that's where the psychology piece is so important, to integrate the shadow. So it's interesting, because I've always had the assumption that if you're enlightened in that sense, if you reach that level of awakening, that you aren't prey to the psychological vices and the ego temptations. But what I'm recognizing is in some ways they're separate. And in other ways, I think spirituality can be a natural kind of expression of the continuum of, you know, like psychological development.
Yeah.
But in some ways, you know, they can be separated. But as you say, I think that finding the wholeness in it is the kind of truly enlightened state requires a level of integrity and shadow integration. There's a way in which people aren't truly reckoning with the shadow and the pain and the trauma, and spirituality can be used as a way to gloss over that. And I would argue that's not a healthy relationship with spirituality. You know, it sounds like you would agree with that.
By and large, I totally agree with everything you said. But then I think of like one of my teachers in particular, who's a Zen teacher in the UK. I write about him in my book, actually, and he's just such a kind man, and he was so deeply enlightened and so unassuming, and, you know, hardly anybody kind of knows about him. You know, he's very quiet, under the radar. He'd been a lawyer, he retired, and then ran two charities for severely disabled people and taught Zen. And he hadn't done a whole lot of psychological work. I mean, he may have done a bit here and there, but it wasn't like he was somebody who'd come through tons of therapy and was really well-versed in it. But he just exuded peace and love in a very sort of humble, unassuming kind of way, and lived this very humble, simple life of service that, you know, and I really, I think he probably, the language of sort of, had he done all this shadow integration of the shadow, I don't know. Because I always think of like, in the realm of spirituality, there's always sort of caveats and exceptions and sort of, so I think it's very hard to say anything categorical in this realm. Like, I mean, I've known people who, you know, they just had one powerful awakening experience, and it just sort of melted their life like a hot knife through butter in the most beautiful way. And, you know, I'm meeting them 25 years later, and they're still sort of radiant and quiet. And it just, you know, and leading exactly a life that sort of suited them, there was great peace around them. And you know, not in positions of authority, like teaching people or anything like that, just quietly embodying a spiritual experience that they'd had, that just sort of they'd allowed to gently kind of radiate through their being more and more, I think. And again, who weren't particularly, I mean, dare I say, sort of sophisticated in the language of psychology or even spirituality, and yet were sort of, you know, of course there could be a little bit of projection here too, but seemed to reside in a kind of, I don't know, radiant, warm, loving way that you could feel around them. I don't know. I'm just saying I'm hesitant about, you know, kind of legislating how it must be, because it's such a weird realm.
I agree with you. And I think not everyone is as neurotic as everyone else. Not everyone has the same degree of trauma as other people. So there are, I think for some of us, like my path, because I'm high in neuroticism and have, you know, some stuff that I've had to work through in terms of my own trauma. I had to do that work. It was inevitable, you know, for me to survive and to be able to integrate anything authentically spiritually. But you're right, there are some folks who they have these awakening experiences and it perhaps doesn't require that same level of reckoning. And I don't feel skeptical of that. When people are deeply embodying love and kindness and you're not seeing any of the kind of red flags in terms of corruption, then, you know, I don't feel skeptical about that. The people I feel skeptical about are people who are overemphasizing that everything is love and light and that there's no space for shadow. So, for example, I had a friend, a kind of new friend a few years ago who I really liked and really connected with. And she was very spiritual. And I was going through something where I had a stalker, and this stalker was like threatening me and saying they were going to, you know, come to my house. And I was really afraid. And then I didn't feel like I was getting the support that I needed from my family. And I was telling my friend about it. And she said something about me playing the victim. And I was so angry. I was like, excuse me, I'm being victimized currently. I'm terrified. I don't feel safe in my home. And you're going to say, you know, just put positive energy in the universe and don't play the victim. So I'm like, I expressed, you know, my hurt and I tried to work it through, and she didn't have any interest in, you know, kind of recognizing where I was at, that I was in pain and that I needed kind of just holding in that. And so I think and that now if I'm 10 years later, I'm still just stewing in victim mentality and blaming and feeling powerless. If that's a theme in my life where I'm engaging with the world from that place, I think there's a proper invitation to step out of that and different ways to look and frame your experience. But when you're in the midst of acutely being, you know, of an acute trauma, to be told that you're playing a victim just feels really antithetical to what I would consider authentic spirituality. Those are more the people that I feel skeptical of, is folks who are just, you know, oh, just positive thinking all the way down. You know, there's no room for anything other than that. And I think that a robust and authentic spirituality has to encompass everything. That doesn't mean every person has to be doing deep shadow work to be awakened. But I think a truly enlightened person has the space to hold people at different phases in their process. Yes. No, otherwise, I don't know if I trust you, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think having, you know, a kind of flexibility in our spiritual practice, you know, that can totally embrace pain, trauma when necessary, whether our own or that of people we meet, is, I couldn't agree more. It's totally healthy. And it's, I think, you know, you get, especially in spiritual communities, you get sort of the spiritual communities that work on transcending self, you know, they'll have implicit sort of hierarchies based on how well they can do, on how much somebody is free of self, you know, so that anytime someone's in pain, oh, you're just being hooked again by yourself. I mean, I agree that can be really counterproductive and unhelpful and even sort of cruel and abusive in worst case scenario. And so I like the idea of if we're gonna venture into spirituality, that it's gotta be kindness first, really. And it's gotta be compassion, kindness, and inclusiveness. I think you said that beautifully earlier. The way I see it actually these days in my mind, there's an old rather kind of little known Chinese Buddhist document that about practice, you know, that says, this is from the late 5th century in China. And so it's pretty early, you know, for Chinese Buddhism, which only starts about 2nd century CE. And it says something like, the path of practice is like a cart track which has two ruts, you know, one for each wheel of the cart. One rut is mindfulness and the other rut is awakening. So they make this sort of distinction between mindfulness meaning the practice of gradual tending, cultivating, developing, healing the human psyche, and then awakening as, you know, awakening to what they call the way in Chinese Buddhism, meaning sort of the way of all things, the arising of everything as one, as empty, as appearance, or whatever, you know, and what we awaken to in awakening sort of thing. But they're saying you got to always have both wheel ruts of the track. I love that. I live by that now, actually. So I can say quite honestly, at a certain point in my training in Zen, I went through a sort of deeper kind of experience that really didn't leave me for 12 years. And then I had some traumatic stuff go on and in my life of people, actually of somebody very, very close to me. And that experience, which I'd been living very naturally and easily, and just this sense of everything always being arising out of this wonder and mystery, you know, it's always present for me, actually. I mean, maybe not absolutely always, but I could always access it anytime. But actually, after 12 years, something happened that changed it, and I couldn't access it. And actually, I didn't want to. I wanted to just be totally grounded in my human heart and helping the best I could. And I needed to help my own heart as well as, you know, the hearts of those immediately around me. I feel it seems like it must be wise to always be open to new growth and development. And if there's a model of, you know, you can hit a real awakening and there's no going back, in a certain way, does that close the door on, you know, new growth? I mean, maybe it doesn't have to, but perhaps it can, you know.
It feels like with any mastery, there are layers and dimensions that you gradually step into and awaken and flush out, and, you know, things that at the beginning you don't even see because you're not even awake enough to have a vision for what those might be. So it just sounds like you're stepping into a new phase of your mastery, and it looks a little different, but you're integrating new aspects of your humanity into your spiritual practice. And that sounds really rich and kind of deep. So,
well, let's hope so. I wouldn't call it my mastery. It's more like my studentship, I suppose, you know, or my learning, you know. It's one thing. Well, I do say one of the nice things about having a real serious spiritual practice is it makes you a lifelong learner, which I think is a really good thing to be. Like of course, there's so many different traditions, and the one that I'm most deeply versed in, Zen, it's not particularly popular these days, but it has some really good things in it. One of which is it's got this map known as the ox herding pictures. It's like 10 pictures that set out this kind of map of spirituality. And, you know, the third one is having an awakening experience. And the fourth one is kind of integrating awakening in our daily life. But then at a certain point, we're supposed to just forget about awakening altogether and just lead a normal life without any hint of awakening in it. You know, but they say it's rather hard to get there, but that's the aspiration. Folded it back into the soil, you know.
What's the saying about before Zen, the mountain is a mountain? Remind me?
Yeah, that would be very relevant. Exactly. Before Zen, or before beginning in Zen or something, a mountain is a mountain. During Zen, a mountain is not a mountain. After Zen, a mountain is again a mountain.
Yeah, there's something about the hero's journey in that, you know, like ordinary mind, kind of confrontation with the unknown, awakening, shift in perception of what the world is, and then returning home with this newfound dimensionality of awakened awareness in ordinary life and ordinary reality.
Yes.
And I think it's, you know, it's interesting for me, having had some very profound kind of awakening experiences, there is a part of me that kind of has a little bit of a perfectionism. Like I'm supposed to always be walking in both worlds, you know, simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to, in my ordinary life, always be awake to all this dimensionality and other kinds of ways of seeing and relating with the world mystically. And, you know, perhaps there's, you know, time and a place for that. But in so many traditions, it seems like the remembering is essential. And in some ways, the forgetting is part of remembering. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Wait, when you say remembering, just let me just get clear. What are you referencing by that?
I'm thinking about the Hindu conception of, you know, we're all basically, I don't know if I'll be able to articulate this properly, but my understanding is, you know, the Hindu concept is that God, in his limitlessness, kind of got bored. There was nothing for him to do. And so he had to gradually begin to play hide and seek with himself by limiting his own powers and awareness. And he had to go further and further as time went on to forget that he was God, to play this game with himself. Right. And then come back to remembering. And so we have in these awakening experiences, these, oh, this kind of remembering of our infinite nature, our, you know, consciousness that is universal. And that's, you know, in some ways built into the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Gotcha. Yeah. I would see it very much like that. I think there is as far as like sort of a spiritual perfectionism or something, you know, I actually feel quite sure that there is a sort of a something that can happen where it's not that we stay in some transcendent state, but the thing that differentiates a transcendent state from an ordinary state can drop away. I know that can happen, and it can get knocked out, like I don't know what would be the, like a window pane or something, and we're just no longer we no longer feel that sort of a quote unquote our transcendent state is different from a most ordinary state. That can happen, and then it's the most amazing thing, because then it's just normal, it's just absolutely ordinary. But what ordinary is endlessly sort of soaks the heart in a kind of love, you know, just ordinary. And to me, that's getting, well, it's as far as I've gone, and to live there is very possible. I know that from personal experience, and it's so beautiful. But it still doesn't mean that there can't be psychological things that come up, and little, of course, blind spots and little, you know, patterns that we get caught in. That can all still happen. I'm sure there are people who go beyond all that, because a lot of people report that there's a phase in spiritual practice where they've kind of seen it, and then they're back to this, you know, neurotic self, and then they see it again, and they're sort of flipping back and forth between something that seems more awakened and something that seems more, I don't know, what do we call it, non-awakened, you know. But actually, and I mean, of course, I'm very familiar with that myself. And as again, I talk about that a lot in my book, but a point can happen where that duality between sort of awakened and very much not awakened, actually that can drop away. And it's not like it then means we're in some totally mind-blowing, you know, blissed out transcendent state or something. It's not that. It's called better than that. It's just ordinary. But somehow so whole and so peacefully total or something. That's one of the great, great fruits of doing it. That's when we're really starting to integrate it, actually, I think.
Yeah, it reminds me of that quote by Yeats, "The world is full of magic things patiently waiting for our senses to grow sharper." And
that's wonderful. Oh,
slowness is sort of a hidden portal into the divine, and that part of the difficulty with accessing that state of peaceful magic of the ordinary daily is just that we move so quickly. And I think I often wonder about the relationship between nervous system regulation and enlightenment.
Oh, or, yeah.
Because my sense is that just getting our systems calm is what wakes us up to this other dimension of being.
That's beautifully put. I totally agree. I mean, that's, I guess, why so many of these traditions have all this emphasis on being still and quiet and settling down.
Yes.
I think you're absolutely right. Oh, man, beautiful. Yeah.
One of the things I've found in my practice is that, you know, I would try to like insert meditation or mindfulness or different practices in my overly programmed schedule. And I had this breakthrough. I was like, oh, like the slowness has to be, there needs to be a bird's eye, you know, component to this where I need to actually create space in my life metaphorically to breathe, as well as, you know, specific times of practice. And of course, the goal is to practice mindfulness and these states in our daily, in every moment of our day. And at the same time, you know, just like if you're learning a sport, you need practice periods to really focus those skills in order to then, you know, more naturally have that muscle memory to play properly. We need those practice periods because we can't efficiently integrate mindfulness into our day unless we can practice it efficiently in isolation, in isolated periods. And so I've often kind of fallen into the thinking like, oh, I'm just going to be more mindful in my daily life. And there are little things I can do that help. But if I don't have those practice periods that are highly focused, I find it doesn't take and it doesn't integrate as easily. It's so easy to kind of just forget.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. And I think another piece for me is like when the momentum has kind of taken over, you know, and I'm actually kind of rushing inwardly as well as outwardly without recognizing it. I suppose for me, the mindfulness piece then is to just be cognizant of this momentum in my body, you know, and not try to stop it, but just be cognizant of it and feel it and feel there's usually some pain in there. Actually, there's usually some little twist mm-hmm. of distress and maybe a little knot of distress, and to feel that and to be kind to it and kind of bring, I suppose, a kind of loving awareness to it, can make all the difference. So I'm really reinforcing and agreeing with you. And just I'm adding this other thing that I find really helpful, which is like, okay, it's not like I've got to totally slow down now, Henry. You know, it's more like, okay, let's just know what's actually going on. And yeah, I may need to stop physically, be still for a moment to get a chance to actually know what that is. And then, but then just to find, yeah, there's this kind of like a momentum in my body, you know, like a flywheel or something wants to keep turning. And
I very much relate to that.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of, you know, the way that you were speaking about, you know, just getting to know this part and we don't have to, you know, slow it down necessarily. It's just bringing kindness and awareness. It reminds me of some of the work I'm doing in IFS right now, where, you know, we presume that every part of us has a positive intention and there are no bad parts of us. They all serve a purpose. And by getting to know them, by listening, by asking them questions, by giving them the attention that they need, they can integrate in a more balanced fashion. Whereas if we ignore them or we try to make them go away, we think they're bad, then they become more extreme. And there's this kind of paradoxical nature to, you know, like the paradoxical theory of change is the more we accept ourselves as we are, the more we could change. And so there's that kind of phenomenon with this is like the more I go, oh, Brooke, you need to slow down, then I make myself bad. I exhale that part of myself. I create this tension that what makes me want to keep going fast to avoid conflict. So there's this kind of, you know, confounding process whereby we try to change ourselves and it actually stokes the fuel for
exactly.
problematic, you know, ways that things that we're trying to avoid. It's sort of like an alcoholic, a shame cycle. They feel terrible about themselves, so they drink, and then they drink and they feel worse about themselves, so then they need to drink more, you know, that kind of, it's a similar phenomenon. These cycles that we have of sort of self-rejection that only feed more self-rejection, more anxiety, more conflict, more disowned parts and splits that perpetuate problems that we have in our lives. And so the antidote rather is to welcome in these parts, get to know them, listen to them so that they can integrate and be part of our board of advisors without any one part calling the shots in isolation. And so I love how, you know, IFS and mindfulness go really beautifully together, because it's just a systematic way of getting to know the different parts of ourselves. That's almost just a slight twist on some of the mindfulness practices, where you're actually speaking to these parts instead of just noticing them. And I find that really rich, because I think that these parts do need to speak and we need to listen to them. And that's a part of what helps us heal, is really understanding all of the different, you know, unconscious parts of ourselves that we've disowned and denied.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things, actually, is when we feel the pain of a part that we don't want to own and welcome, and then that shifts into loving it. I think that's one of the most beautiful things. And then the very pain becomes very beautiful, you know, and it's all about our heart. So we're recovering our more and more terrain and territory of our own heart as I feel it, you know. And I love IFS, by the way. It's a great system. It really is. I feel.
Yeah. That's beautiful, recovering the terrain of our heart, reclaiming more and more territory, broadening the expanse of our internal horizons and, you know, capacity of what we can hold. That's a really beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for your time. It's wonderful to be with you and connect. I'm so grateful. I love this conversation. Any final words that you'd like to share before we say goodbye?
Well, I want to thank you very much. And I you know, it's so great to talk with somebody like you, Brooke, who's really interested in exactly the same sort of area of human development and or areas that I am. It's lovely to connect like that. Thank you.
So wonderful. I feel like we'll have many more conversations on the horizon. We didn't even get into poetry today, so I kind of want a different podcast on that. Well, thank you so much, Henry, and we'll do it again soon.
Okay. Thank you so much.